No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Please call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. We're lucky to have with us tonight a special guest, Angela Peabody. But first, let me introduce my co-host, Maria Sanchez. Maria, how are you?
I'm great, Michael, and thank you for this opportunity to help promote something that's a little bit off of what we ordinarily do on the program. And also just to our listeners, the conversation might be a little graphic, so be aware, because we are going to be speaking about female genital mutilation and Angela's organization and the event that we want to help promote. Which I'm participating in, and Michael, you may join us if the stars align.
Yeah, no, I will be there, and let me just say that when you first suggested that we have Angela on the show, yeah, I thought to myself that this is a little bit different from really what we do, but then when you told me that this involves hundreds of millions of women...
First of all, 200 million.
200 million women. First of all, I was shocked at that. And then second of all, I said anything that involves 200 million women should involve all of us. So
thank you.
That's why we've asked Angela to be here tonight, and we're so excited to have her. So please, you introduce her let's get going. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to give just the overview about Global Woman Peace Foundation, which she's the executive director and founder of, and it's a 501c3, and it's primarily founded on the principles of eliminating violence and injustices against women and girls. But she also held the first walk to end female genital mutilation in the United States, and that is what we're going to be participating in on Saturday, October 19th, in the District of Columbia. So it's a international crisis, it is a national solution, and it is a specific event. So we've got a lot of things going on, and Angela has an illustrious career before she came to the United States. But without further ado, Angela Peabody, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for what you do and for being available for us today.
Thank you, Maria, and thanks to the Senator for having me. It's my pleasure.
Absolutely.
And it's our privilege. Yes. Thank you, Michael, too, because Angela, can you go into your history in Liberia, and then we'll go into Global Woman Peace Foundation so people have some perspective about that of which you speak?
Okay, I'll just be quick. I was born in Monrovia, Liberia, the country's capital, which is located on the west coast of Africa. And I spent most of my life there. And because of a very bloody coup d'etat in the country, decades ago, my family and I immigrated to the United States, and we made the U.S. our home. And I've been here ever since. I raised my two sons here, and America now is our home. But when I lived in Liberia, I was press secretary to the agriculture minister, and I was also a radio broadcaster, a television broadcaster. And I came to the U.S. and I had to make adjustments to my career because I couldn't get a job. I had a very thick accent and I couldn't get a job in broadcasting. So I made some adjustments to make a living and to be able to support me and my family.
And then let's talk about the Global Women Peace Foundation.
And then
what brought you to that and why?
Yes, I realized after growing up in Liberia, which is a big practicing country, FGM practicing country, I realized that when I came to America years later, I encountered a story about female genital mutilation. And the only thing I knew in Liberia was something called female circumcision. That's what they called it at the time I was growing up there. And I was exposed to it. It was not done to me because my parents didn't practice it, but I was exposed to it through other girls. But I didn't make the connection with female genital mutilation and female circumcision until years later after I lived in the U.S. and I discovered that it was one of the same. And I was just flabbergasted and I just became relentless in my research and wanting to know more about it. And I knew that it was a cultural act. And I just kept probing and probing until I ended up interviewing the first survivor, FGM survivor, and discovered that she was from Somalia and it had been done to her when she was 5 years old. And then I started more research and I started meeting more survivors from various countries in the world.
Now, were you meeting these survivors in the United States or in their countries?
In the United States. They were right here in the U.S., even though most of them, it had been done to them in their countries of origin when they were little girls, but they now live here, and I was meeting them here. And it was just astounding to me to know that this thing, this archaic practice, was still going on years later. And then when I found out that it was happening right here in the United States, that just triggered my passion for wanting it to stop, because what they were doing was taking little girls out of the United States to the countries of origin, their parents' countries of origin or their grandparents' countries of origin, to have it done to them, and they were bringing them back into the U.S. So I got involved with that campaign in 2013, and this was the year before we put on our first walk to end FGM, which was 2014. But 2013, we went to Capitol Hill and collaborated with other organizations, and we got the attention of Congress, some Congress members, and it was a bipartisan effort. They wrote a letter to President Obama and told him this was a serious problem in this country. And so they amended the law, the FGM law of 1996 that was initially passed. They amended it in 2013 and added the clause for vacation cutting, which prohibits parents from taking their little girls out of the country, out of the U.S., into other countries to have it done to them. And I didn't stop there. I just kept on plugging away until a senator from Virginia, a Virginia senator, approached us and asked us, would we work with him to put forth a bill in Virginia, because here I am in Virginia and our organization is a Virginia-based organization, and I just couldn't believe that there was no law against it in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So we went to Richmond and we testified to the Virginia Senate and the General Assembly that this thing is existing and that Virginia was number four state, the number four state of the prevalence of it in the U.S., and that we needed a law against it. So they passed the law in 2017, but it was only a misdemeanor, and we were not satisfied with that because being from a practicing country and understanding the mentality of the people who practice this, a misdemeanor is a slap on the wrist, and it would not even deter them whatsoever from continuing to practice it. So we went back to Richmond in 2018 with the same senator, and we requested that they amend the bill, amend the law to a harsher penalty. And we were successful there last year. They amended it to the law to a class two felony, which carries 25 to life in the state of Virginia. And also the law included vacation cutting, not only for taking the girls overseas, but even taking them across state line into the district or into West Virginia or any other state in the U.S. for that purpose. It is a class two felony. So we were pleased with the harsher penalty.
Well, let me ask you, Angela, because I think we're putting the cart in front of the horse here a little bit, because I really didn't understand what this was all about. So could you explain, I mean, first of all, what is it exactly that they do to women? Why? Is it a cultural thing? Is it a religious thing? What is it that motivates people to do this in the first place?
Well, before you answer that, Angela, and Michael, thank you for that. I just wanted to kind of get the overview, and now we can drill down into the specifics, and then this is where it's going to get a little bit graphic, because Angela, you can describe the four types. So FGM stands for female genital mutilation, and we use that term interchangeably. So if you hear it's an acronym. And then, Angela, if you don't mind going through the four types, and then we can address the cultural issues and that it's not religiously mandated and that it precedes the Bible and the Quran, for starters.
Yes. Yes. Thanks for saying that, Maria. First, let me just usually what I like to do is define female genital mutilation, which, like Maria said, the acronym is FGM. Female genital mutilation is, according to the World Health Organization, is the intentional removal of either all or part of the external female genitalia for no medical reason at all. There's no medical reason for it to be done. And what they do when they perform this on little girls, they restrain them forcibly, then, and the trauma that they suffer from just the restraint, they remove either, they excise either the entire clitoris, which is type one is the clitoridectomy. That's what it's called. And in that case, they excise either the whole clitoris or they excise only the tip of it. The purpose is to make sure that the girl has no sensation there. And
Angela, may we say that it's done without any pain medication, and
no,
it's often done with not a scalpel, but a rusty razor blade or a shard of glass or an axe.
Yes. Yes, it's not done in a clinical environment. It's not done under anesthesia. So the girl is, it, first of all, she's subjected to a lot of infection because it's not clinical, and the instruments used, as Maria said, are either sawed off, razor blade, rusty. If it's been used multiple times on other girls, so there's the risk of HIV also. And she the restraint they hold her down forcibly, three women holding her down, one of them sitting on her chest, while she kicks and screams and fights, and while they cut it off. And most times they are drunk, they're intoxicated, the women, when they are doing this. I guess they have to get intoxicated to be able to do that to a little girl screaming and kicking, and they could miss. And I've met several young women who it was done to when they were little girls, but the women were so intoxicated that they just sliced it off and just left it skin hanging and keloids and a lot of mass flesh. So it's nothing that is real. It's pretty for them. And so clitoridectomy is type 1, where they either remove the whole clitoris or the tip of it. Type 2 is called the excision, and they remove the entire clitoris, and then they remove
Labia.
what the yes the labia, which is the labia minora, the small lip as they refer to it. They remove that. Type 3 is the infibulation type, and that is the most, I think all types are really, really bad, but type 3 is the most terrible of all, because they perform the clitoridectomy, which is type 1, they perform excision type 2, and then they remove the labia minora, I mean the minora and the majora, so they remove both lips, and whatever skin is left, they pull it together and stitch it up, leaving only a tiny opening, maybe the size of your nail, your pinky nail, to accommodate urination and later on menstruation. So it's really, really terrible what they do to little girls. And
Well, and then type 4 is some kind of cutting or nicking.
yes, type 4, they refer to it as other. So it includes nicking, pricking, scraping, cauterizing of the vagina, and so it's all of those things that can be done. Pricking of the clitoris, that's type 4.
And then the sewing, I'm sorry, Michael, the sewing that's done is often with thorns
Yeah, with a rope,
or
a rope.
twine or something
Yes.
to sew the flesh together. And then they're bound from their thighs to their ankles for like 10 days so
Yes.
that the sewing heals, if you will. And that's just it in a nutshell, Michael. If that doesn't turn your stomach, I don't know what would.
Well, you know what? I mean, what I want to get on to is why and what we can do about it. And it seems to me, with what you're talking about, with thorns and ropes and all these other things, that it's very ritualistic. So where does the ritual come from? Is there any religious connection to this? Is
No.
it a cultural thing?
Yes, it's cultural. I think Maria mentioned earlier, it predates religion. So it's not, if you look in the Quran, it's not, there's nothing, imams of Muslim imams have said there's nothing in the Quran and about it about female circumcision. If you know the Holy Bible, there's nothing in it. There's nothing in the Jewish Torah. So it predates religion. And to go into a little history of it, it originated in Egypt during the Pharaoh time. This practice it's more than 5,000 years old. And the Pharaoh thought that it would be a good way to keep their daughters virgins until they got married by removing what stimulates them. So they decided to start doing that. So that's how old this practice is. And then it later on trickled down to sub-Saharan Africa and parts of the Middle East and then parts of Asia. And it just kept spreading. And the reason why it's so old, people ask me, how did they keep this a secret? Why are we just finding out about this in the Western world? And it's because they swear the girls to secrecy. Like you said, Senator, it's a ritual, it's a ritualistic thing. It's a cultural ritualistic thing. And they swear them to secrecy and tell them, if you tell anyone what happened to you here, your stomach will swell, you will die. One young lady told me that she went to school after she was healed, and she tested it out and told her friend what had happened, and she waited to see if her stomach would swell or she would die, and she's still alive today in her 40s, and she was 11 years old at the time. So that's when she realized they lied to her, and she was going to talk about it. But most of the young women, no matter what country they're from, that it was done to them, they are terrified. Even today, when some of them are adults and have their own children, they are still terrified to talk about it because they think that something spooky will happen to them if they talk about it. Some of the women that come to us, that's why we have the support group, because they don't want to talk about it. We have to really counsel them and bring it out of them. And then they realize, well, nothing's going to happen to me if I talk about it. So that's how they have gotten away with this for many, many centuries, because they swear
the secrecy.
Secrecy, yes.
Right. The other thing, Michael, is it's incentivized in some communities that a woman who is cut is more desirable as a bride and then can generate a bigger dowry, which benefits the family of the girl that got cut. And the cutters, the women who do the cutting, they get paid for cutting also.
Yes.
So there's an industry here as well.
Yes. It is. They get paid, and that's what a lot of people in the Western world don't know or don't realize. They get paid handsomely for it and on any given day when it's done, the cutters can cut up to 100 girls at a time in one day. And the average, I know in Liberia, they get paid about $300 per girl. So that's a lot of money in a place like Liberia or even Sierra Leone or some other poor countries. That's a lot of money that they are making from these little girls, from torturing and mutilating these little girls.
$30,000? That's a lot of money in the United States.
Yeah,
that's
in one
anywhere.
Day.
Yeah, and that's in one day.
I mean, so you see, there's, and it's also ultimately about men controlling the sexuality of women.
Yes.
Well, that goes on all over the world, doesn't it? But,
yes.
But let me ask you: you've gotten Virginia to pass this law. Do other states in the United States have similar laws, or is Virginia stand alone on this?
Oh, no. Virginia was the 27th state in the U.S. to pass the law. When I started this work, they only had about 24 states that had passed laws, like New York, when the 1996 federal law went into place. That's when states like New York and New Jersey and Maryland and West Virginia, they put forth their laws. But a lot of states hadn't passed the laws, like Virginia.
Well, so, what difference?
But just this year alone, when we started 2019 in January, there were only 28 states that had passed laws against FGM. Just this year alone, we now are up to 34 states. So,
well,
and counting.
I'm sorry, Angel. If there's a federal law, why do we even need a state law? Doesn't the federal law supersede the state law? Wouldn't a federal law make it illegal everywhere in the United
States?
Well,
that's what we would think. But I will share with you what happened in April of 2017, just 2 years ago, in Michigan. Michigan was one of those states that didn't have a law against FGM in 2017. And the FBI, and that's why the FBI had to make the bust in Michigan, because these doctors, Indian doctors, were practicing it right in their clinic in the middle of Detroit. Mm. And somebody must have tipped the feds off about it, and they made this major bust. It was the very first time that an FGM case was going to be prosecuted in the United States, and this was a big case.
Because it also involved interstate transfer of the girls.
Yes, because the girls were being transported from states like Minnesota that already had laws. So since they knew that Michigan didn't have a law, they were bringing them there and having it done to them. And the FBI questioned these little girls. The girls testified. They were 7 years old, age range between 7, 6, and 8. And they did admit that described what was done to them. So we knew that, oh, now we have them. Well, the doctors, not only the two doctors were prosecuted, but also the mothers that took them, that took the little girls to the doctors, were also prosecuted. And then last year, November, we advocates got the shock of our lives when the judge in Michigan threw out the case, the federal judge, and said that it was unconstitutional for U.S. Congress to have passed a law against FGM, that it should be something taken on state by state. Well, Michigan, because the Michigan governor at the time moved quickly after that FBI arrest, he moved quickly to pass the law and he signed the bill. So everything happened in 2017. Well, the state couldn't prosecute these people because they would have argued that it was not a law at the time the crime was committed. Therefore, it was not a crime. So we were stuck. They've appealed. They have been a couple of appeals on this case. And so far, we haven't gotten anywhere with it. So when the federal law was put in place in 1996, very little in the United States was known about FGM. So they didn't include a lot of things. They didn't cross all the T's and dot all the I's. And that's why this federal judge in 2018 would throw out the case.
Last year.
Yes.
So it's in limbo, Michael, to answer your question.
But the thing that I'm still confused about, Angela, is what was the base? Do you know what the basis of the judge's decision was that federal law didn't apply, that had to be handled by the states? Was it I mean, do you know what the basis was for his decision?
I'm sorry?
What the basis was for his decision on why federal law, why it had to be handled by the states?
He said he found some clause where he justified that it was unconstitutional for U.S. Congress to pass the law in 1996, that they were not, they should not have constitutionally passed it. So that, based on that, the case was thrown out. So now we are working on with staffers on Capitol Hill to rephrase, to rewrite, practically rewrite the entire law, federal law, so that this will no longer happen. And that's why we started pushing more for states, individual states, to have their own laws in the event something like this happens, not to depend solely on federal law. So that is the reaction that we got this year, with five states passing their own state laws because of what happened last year with the federal judge.
And I want to make a little case about this too, Michael, that it has been stated by the World Health Organization and UNICEF and the United Nations that 500,000 women are alive today that are cut in the United States.
Yes.
Whether they were brought here cut, or they got cut here, or they were taken to be cut and came back. And that number is also repeated in the United Kingdom and in the European Union. So that's why they're saying now it's not just about Africa, it's global. And then the caveat that's coming up too is there are some legal experts saying that you cannot discriminate between female genital mutilation and male circumcision. If you can't cut female genitalia, then you can't cut male genitalia. And they're trying to put those two together. And that's also creating kind of a logjam.
Yeah, I would think that would be a hard thing. I would say, you know, if I was the political strategist behind this, I would say separate the two. Because that's, you know, it seems to me they're totally different.
Well,
it's
the men's rights
and oranges.
They're saying, hey, genital integrity is genital integrity. And if you discriminate, then that's sexist, that
well,
you're
first,
discriminating.
First, because those people who are making that argument, they must not fully understand female genital mutilation. It is totally different from male circumcision. I have two sons, and my husband and I had both of them circumcised. Because there is something to remove that will help, unless you want. I didn't know how to teach my boys how to clean, push the skin back and clean themselves. I didn't know it. My husband didn't know how. He had been circumcised. So we didn't want to get involved in that. So we had them circumcised. There is the skin to be removed. On the
and it's done medically. It's done medically and hygienically
and
sanitarily.
Yes, it's done in a hospital.
I circumcised my three sons and I regret it. But it's only because I've been following this for 20 years that now I understand that you ought not to cut off skin that's viable. But whatever. In America, 80% of us were circumcising. Right. Now it's down to about 40% circumcising the men. Like, my brother is circumcised. My dad was. My brothers are. But he chose not to circumcise his two sons. So there is a change in sentiment.
But there's such a strong cultural and religious association with that in the United States. That would be my hesitation in trying to bring the two of them together. Is you're just putting up another barrier to getting rid of it for women, and obviously it's not even in this, it's in the same region of the body, but other than that, I can see no similarity between the two procedures. Let me ask you, since it's women that take their little girls, it sounds like, very often have this done, what do we need to do with those women? Is it a matter of education? Is it are these relatively uneducated women that do this, or is this found across? I just came back from India, for example. You mentioned that Indian doctors were doing it in Michigan. Well, there's plenty of educated people in India. They have over 1,000 universities there. So do you find that this happens with less educated women? Is that part of the problem?
I believe that if you educate, and I'm looking at it from an African perspective with women, that if you educate the women, they are not going, you will have less of the practice. In India, for example, they practice it there in the Bora community,
right?
But they are educated. They are doctors, right? And they are, right, educated. So I don't know why they would. The only thing I can think of is it's the culture. It's the culture that dictates it. But I still push for education.
Wait a second, before we run out of time, because that's what Global Peace Foundation is about, and that's what the event is about, because I want to talk about what you do with the funds, Angela, that are going to be raised on this 5K, because she's got boots on the ground in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and is it Ghana?
Guinea.
And that's where these funds are going to go. And also want to promote how you can register to walk, or how you can sponsor somebody to walk. Because at the end of the day, it comes down to some money.
Right. Yes.
And they Angela also passes out sanitary pads, because they're not readily available. They're not affordable. And if a woman, a girl is menstruating, she stays home for school in order to accommodate that is what is happening. So Angela's encouraging education in the girls with the parents and making it possible. So can you talk about that, Angela? Because that's really important to this conversation.
Yes, we have four programs. And the one that Maria is interested in and was just mentioning is called our Just For You program for the girls. And that's our international program. There are many girls, hundreds of thousands of them in West Africa and other parts of the continent that miss school for a whole week sometimes because they don't have sanitary napkins. Either their parents cannot afford it, or they just don't have access to it because they're in remote villages. So we decided to, and most of those girls that need sanitary pads they are survivors of FGM. So we decided to start collecting sanitary pads here in the United States and shipping them overseas to those countries for the girls to be able to attend school and not miss school every month. In addition to that, we came up with the idea of how do we get these mothers to not send their girls into the bush to have this thing done to them. So we decided to offer a scholarship to girls in those countries, in those practicing countries. But we will not just offer the scholarship and hand over the money to them. We want their mothers, their parents to sign an agreement, a legal agreement stating that they will not, if we pay for their girls' education, they will not have their girls cut. So this is not for girls who have already been cut, but this is for girls who have not been cut in order to help protect them from it happening. This is the road to, part of the road to ending this thing. And once those little girls are educated, we know that they will not subject their girls, when they become women, they will not subject their daughters to the same thing. So we're offering the scholarship to the girls who have not been cut, and their parents will have to sign an agreement and stick with it.
And submit to a health exam once a year to make sure that they haven't been cut.
Yes.
And let me ask you something. Since you have this program where you give sanitary products to women, are the companies that produce these products, are they corporate sponsors of what you do?
We have not even gotten that far yet. We were planning on approaching Kotex and Always and the rest of them, but we had one hospital in the Arlington area donate 500 pads to us last year. We had the Rotary Club of Tyson's Corner, Rotary Club of McLean. They partnered with us and collected hundreds of pads for us, and we were able to ship them to West Africa. Right now, I have in my possession 2,000 plus pads, preparing to ship them to Liberia. So we alternate the countries and send them to Liberia, to Sierra Leone, and to Guinea.
Well, you need somebody passionate like Maria Sanchez to go after those people, because you know what? They should be kicking in some money, right? They really should. They have a vested interest in this. And
yeah, or in-kind donation.
Yeah, absolutely. They should be making in-kind donations. And if there's 200 million women in the world that have had this done to them, they, you know, it would be a great PR thing for them, I would think, to be involved in. And you know, and it also, you know, as strange as this may sound, because it really deals with the business aspect of all this, they have, you know, the more of their products they get into these countries, the more sales they make. You know, if they can get people to use their products, even if they have to donate them to begin with, it opens up markets for them, I would imagine.
Absolutely, so, it would.
Yeah. Well, there was a documentary made last year that won the Academy Award. It's called Period, End of Sentence, and it's about work that communities in Africa have done so that the women can make their own sanitary pads. But
yes.
Michael, what you're talking about is a great partnership corporately. You know, let's help the planet. But before we run out of time, Angela, tell our listeners how they can get involved with the walk on Saturday, October 19th.
Yes, they can go to our website, globalwomanpeacefoundation.org, and that is woman, W-O-M-A-N, Peace foundation.org, and register to walk on October 19th. It's on at the Washington Monument, the National Sylvan Theater, right next to the monument. We gather there every year, every October, and then the evening before the walk, we will be at George Washington University, the Milken Institute. You will find all that information on the walk registration site, and that's where we will have the Global Woman Awards, and we're also going to have a panel discussion by FGM experts, advocates who are experts in the field. So please, if you want to know more about FGM that you couldn't find out tonight on the show, please make sure you come on the 18th of October in the evening at 6 o'clock, and you will learn a lot from that panel discussion.
And I'll be at both events. And if you can't come because you're out of the area, you have a conflict, you can help sponsor me, because I have a page there, so does Angela, about just contributing, even if it's $5. It all adds up.
Yes. That's right. And Senator, I hope you will join us.
Yes, absolutely. You know, this is it's an important empowerment issue for women. Besides the obvious terrible trauma it causes to each individual woman, it really seems to me to be an issue that women need to band together and stand up, especially women in developed countries that don't really, well, I was going to say they don't have to put up with this, but if we have 500,000 people in our own country that have this, it affects everybody. And I think that women need to band together and stand up and say, enough is enough. We're not going to tolerate this anymore.
Well, not to mention, we haven't even gone into the lifelong complications, which are incredibly severe, that the women suffer from. Let alone what intercourse is like, what childbirth is like, all the other infections. And I mean, it's traumatic. It continues to traumatize.
Well, we would need about 3 hours or more to be able to talk about, to cover everything about FGM.
And Michael, I really want to thank you for allowing this conversation to happen, because it makes me so angry. I can barely stand. I want to do, you know, and it's visceral, my passion about this. And then to have give Angela the format for her to share exactly what it is that she's doing right here in the United States. You know, we're not talking about across the Atlantic Ocean anymore. It's here too.
Look, I got to be honest with you. I had second thoughts about this, and it makes me uncomfortable to talk about it. But obviously, there's something that's got to be done, and we have to have these uncomfortable conversations about it in order to end it. I mean, I'm the father of two daughters. I just think the things that you said today, what's going on, is just barbaric. And, it's incumbent on all of us to stand up and have these conversations, even if they are uncomfortable. And I'm so glad that you have taken this on, this Peabody. Thank you for the work you do on behalf of women worldwide.
Well, and Angela mentioned that it started in Egypt. We're talking about 91% of the women and girls in Egypt are cut. Somalia has the world's highest, 98% of the women and girls are cut in that country. We're not talking about the exception here. Right. This is a global crisis.
Right. A global crisis that is uncomfortable for men, at least anyway. I can attest to that, to talk about. And maybe that's one of the reasons that it persists in such great numbers. So let's get over our discomfort and all sit down and talk about it, because
I really appreciate you even participating in this conversation, Senator, because I agree with you. I have been in the room when I do presentations, and I see the discomfort on men's faces. They are cringing. It's painful to hear, but they sit there and they bear it and they hear it. And we're trying to get more men involved, because, you know, the funny thing is, the women who do it, they believe that they are doing it for the men's benefit, because if they feel that their daughters will not be marriageable if they're not cut, and that men will not want to marry them. Well, that was the old time, but not now. Mm. The young men I speak with, they are totally against it. They don't want a woman who's been tampered with. They don't.
Right. I'm sure that's true. Well, we're out of time, but thank you so much. And I encourage everybody, go support Maria. Come to the event if you're local. We're going to leave you with the song tonight. For all those women out there that need to stand up and fight this, it's a song by Rachel Platten. Thank you so much, Ms. Peabody, for being our guest. And thank you so much, Maria, for standing up for this. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Like a small boat on the ocean, sending big waves into motion, like how a single word can make a heart open. I might only have one match, but I can make an explosion.
In the capital of this nation, 200 years of exploitation, give the people their right to vote.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.